happening now. We want to welcome our viewers from across the United States and around the world. This is the EdTech Situation Room. Good morning, good day, good evening. This is EdTech Situation Room, episode number 306 on September 27th, 2023. My name is Jason Neifer. I am the executive director of the Montana Digital Academy, which is Montana State Virtual School, with offices on the beautiful University of Montana campus in Almost Fall, Missoula, Montana. And joining me tonight, as always, good evening, Dr. Westfryer. How are you tonight, sir?
Good evening, Jason. I am well and excited to be anticipating the marriage of our first child imminently and having a good spring. So we had actually a three-day weekend, so got to do a little camping up in the mountains, and fall is definitely in the air here in North Carolina, so getting into the 60s. I think it got into the 50s up in the mountains. So is the fire danger officially over with rain and no more smoke, or what's up with that?
It's not over, although we did have, I think, maybe two smoky-ish days last week, and I think those were still Canadian fires, but our weather is definitely hitting the fall realm. And I was just going to look to see, it's homecoming week at the University of Montana, which means that there'll be a football game on Saturday and a lot of events outdoors on Friday. And I think the high is going to be like 71, but it's getting cold at night. This morning it was 48 when I got up, which is a chilly September day. But I'm excited. I love the fall. It's my second favorite season. And, I am looking forward to, soup season and all the things that come with fall.
Now it is a bit of a busy time for you though, but maybe it's always busy.
Yeah, it's never not busy, is what I've listened in the last couple of years, but, I've spent a lot of time. Well, I will start traveling, next week, and it's gonna be once a week for basically a month and a half. And in fact, I will not be available for our show next week, as it turns out, but, I'll be in Denver, Colorado for the Virtual Learning Leadership Alliance, meetings with, all the other state virtual schools that are part of that wonderful organization. Talking AI will be part of my role there. And in fact, I mean, I think I have five or six more gigs, booked, a couple out of state, couple in state, on AI. And I'm really excited because I'm going to start working with student groups in 2 weeks. So I'm going to take a day and go hang out at Sentinel High School in Missoula in a couple of English classes and start working directly with high school students on this, which it's been a while since I've been around that particular group of kiddos, but I'm really excited. It's a real good opportunity. And I don't know, you know, Steve Jobs famously said in his Stanford a speech that, you know, the stars never align in front of you. They always align behind you. And in a lot of ways, I think, you know, a lot of the stuff that I've done, you know, has prepared me to be part of these important conversations. And certainly my time with you each week and the opportunity to talk to educators on the ground, I think these conversations are what's going to help us figure out what AI does and doesn't do in context of teaching and learning.
Yes, and it is absolutely wonderful to not only get together as we do, just to visit and see each other. What a wonderful thing amidst the transitions of our lives moving across the country and being able to maintain the show in our Wednesday evening get-togethers. But yeah, I totally agree, because this is where not only am I made aware of many life-changing tools. I'm using Upscale just about every day now.
Me too.
And Claude so all much. The time,
yeah.
You know.
Claude's great.
And so, but hey, welcome Peggy George. It was only 105 degrees in Phoenix today, so thankfully Peggy is in air conditioning. But it's great to have you back with us. And we might have my dad with us. We actually have three viewers. So if you're tuning in live, maybe Eric Langhorst, we don't know. Just say hello. We're glad you're here. What are we going to do besides, you know, go through our little introduction of weather and life plans, Jason? Are we going to talk about some technology stuff?
Yeah, there's a lot going on in the tech world, as it turns out. And, you know, we'll see, you know, how quickly we get kind of sucked into, the AI stuff. But, this week we obviously have some AI articles. I would like to announce that I picked up an iPhone 15 Pro. And so it, Betsy Springer in the chat room tonight as well. Hey, Betsy. the I picked up an iPhone 15 Pro, and I'll talk about it when we get to Apple stuff, but I can give a kind of a basic review, and I'm actually very happy that I went in this direction. So it's got a couple little issues that I think will be resolved at some point, but so far so good. We also have some social media stuff, some war and military discussions, our miscellaneous category, and of course we'll end this week with our Geeks of the Week. Dr. Fryer, you put a lot of great stuff in this week. Is there a particular location you'd like to start?
Well, yes, I think we'll hold off a little bit for the AI because there are some fantastic AI articles. Let's start with this war military one, and this is actually a thread on, I guess we'll say X, the site formerly known as Twitter. This is a very interesting account called Saint Javelin, but I had shared, I think, basically this is a $1,000 drone taking out a $3 to $4 million Russian T-72 tank. There are a series of these videos. Interestingly, manufactured in China, if you read the thread, they'll talk about the Switchblade drones, which are much more expensive, but I think cost about 30 times as much as these little $1,000 drones, and how they, you know, have strapped a RPG-7 warhead and are flying this thing fly-by-wire. And some of these things, you see them fly, like, directly into the bunkers of the Russians. And then, of course, it blows up. They've got these – it's surreal. And so, you know, I'm thankful to have not had to, watch the nightly news during the Vietnam War. I was far too young to remember any of that. But it is a sobering reminder of the fact that we do have an ongoing war happening in Europe. But also the role of technology. And what I was going to say, I've shared the last couple of weeks that we've been on, you know, some things about U.S. military strategy. There was an article I think we had about these robotic submarines that Australia is purchasing, and then an article about the United States Air Force and a big reversal in the strategy that the Air Force is formally taking to plan to counter mainly China. But these little inexpensive drones, like the things that you and I can go down to Costco or probably go on Amazon, you know, and order ourselves, are playing a huge role in the war. And so one of the things I think this thread talks about too, and these are some things that students are participating in with drones. There's races that they'll have with drones where they'll have the headset on and flying. And man, if you haven't seen some of those videos, I think we might have shared some of those in the past. But anyway, that's just, you know, it is technology. It's the war being brought to us live. There is certainly a level of, you know, official messaging or propaganda that's involved here. There are issues about, you know, is this disinformation? Is this authentic? You know, how is this being vetted? There's all kinds of things that are going on with all this that it sort of brings to mind.
Yeah, and I'm just, I got kind of sucked into this thread as it turns out, but the whole notion that, you know, they're able to inflict an extraordinary amount of damage for $1,000 as opposed to a tank, which costs $3 to $4 million. I know that when drones started becoming a kind of a thing in regards to the extraordinary, I keep thinking about airports, right? That when drones were starting to become complicated around airports and before they had rules. But I remember reading some kind of future looking text at the time that talked about how, you know, the other complication of all this is that at some point it could just be drone warfare, like drone v drone, that would be both extraordinary and a little science fiction-y.
Absolutely.
As it turns out too. And there are also, I mean, there's an AI play here, in part because AI at some point could enable autonomous drones.
And that's what that article, which I think we talked about from the U.S. Air Force that was in the New York Times, that we did that 2 weeks ago. And that vision is human pilots with literally hundreds of AI autonomous you know, drones that are not just the fly-by-wire humans behind each one of them, but actually have AI controlling them and have the authority to engage targets, to you know, to shoot, to blow stuff up. But there's a term for them that they've used where they are. It's not, the word isn't expendable, but that's basically what it is. That this is a, you know, compared to an F-35, which there was an interesting situation that happened with an F-35 getting lost as the pilot ejected, I think, but since our last show. Anyway, it's a big deal. And the role of technology and the ethics of this, because the United States military has historically said that they're always going to have a person with their finger on the trigger and not just release, you know, what some people would call a killer robot to say, here's the face you need to go find, go, you know, they've changed that policy. And I think, you know, when we have statements from Sam Altman and all these luminaries in the tech world that, you know, AI is an equivalent challenge, it offers the potential for existential harm to all of us. These things are sobering. So anyway, that's a bit of a downer, but there's a complex array of issues there, and there's not any graphic violence in terms of seeing, you know, blood and dismemberment or, you know, anything like that in these videos. In this sense, it's a bit video game-ish, but this is not a video game. So depending on your situation with the age of your students, you know, certainly if you're teaching college students, I don't know. I think there's a lot here to talk about, and there's issues for us to think about as a public in terms of what we are authorizing and what kinds of things we do policy-wise with our smart weapons. And then, like I said, there's also propaganda and disinformation, and, you know, we're going to go in the election cycle soon, and you know, it's, let's just brace ourselves now, because these, the AI tool, I mean, wait, yeah, what are we going to talk about ChatGPT this week? Multimodal, you know, I mean, it's just incredible how fast this stuff is changing.
Yep, absolutely so.
Okay, you want to talk about some other non-AI stuff?
I would love to talk about my new iPhone.
Okay, just dude, because tell I'm us,
a big dork. So I think I maybe mentioned this a couple weeks back, but I wasn't sure how I was going to upgrade, because one of the things I've been doing lately with my unlocked phone, I paid off my phone from T-Mobile, and so it was unlocked, and I've been actually carrying two SIMs on my phone. And so one SIM was an eSIM from Visible, which is on the Verizon network, and then my traditional T-Mobile SIM. And the reason why I like that is because there's lots of places in the state of Montana where there's a Verizon signal, but there isn't a T-Mobile signal. And so I wanted to be able to, continue that if I could, because it allows me to, you know, get on my laptop if I'm out at school visit in a town that's dominated by a Verizon signal. I can just switch my carrier and then use that as a mobile hotspot. And I've been very happy with that. I know that a lot of people don't like Visible as their primary source. It is killer awesome as your secondary SIM. And I think I'm paying like $20 a month for unlimited data. But the hotspot data is limited to, I think it's 10 megabits down, which, you know, 10 years ago would have been, you know, like wild fast. So, you know, we're happy with that. And then when I started kind of playing around with my T-Mobile account, I figured out that I apparently spent, for 60 days in 2021, they had up some promotion called Upgrade Forever. And what that does is give me $800 every 2 years to upgrade to the newest iPhone. And, they're going to pay me $450 for my existing iPhone, which was $100 more than Apple was willing to pay for it. And then they're going to give me $350 in monthly credits. And if in 2 years I haven't paid off the phone yet, then they'll just cancel the rest of my payments. And then, allow me to upgrade again to a new phone for cheap. So I decided to go that route. And I'm very happy with it. It looks beautiful. The titanium look is very understated in comparison to the past phones. I was really in love with kind of the light blue color and also the kind of mint green color. This is the blue titanium, very nice materials. It looks super great. I hear it's a fingerprint magnet, but it's not lived outside of a case. Actually, this is the first time it's been out of the case since I bought the thing. So we'll be popping that right back in there. It's certainly faster. The cameras seem better. But what I love about this phone is the USB-C port. And it is such an improvement over the Lightning port. And there's been a couple of articles in the last couple of weeks saying that the new iPhone will change the experience for hotel room or people that stay in hotel rooms, because they said your phone with one cable now can easily, you know, plug in the back of your TV. And I can confirm that's exactly how it works. I was around a TV and I grabbed a USB to HDMI cable, USB-C to HDMI cable, which I have two or three of, and it turns out I was able just to pop my phone onto the TV, and then I played a Netflix movie, and now there's a Netflix movie on my television. I actually carry around with me in my larger bag, not my kind of 2 or 3 day bag, my week-long bag. I have, I think it's a Google TV, the Walmart $20 Google TV that I have sitting in a little pouch that's got all the cables and the power for that, which is usually what I do when I'm in a hotel, but I'm not sure if that's going to be necessary anymore. And I don't know why I didn't think to do this with my iPad, which has a USB-C port on it too, right? But it's really extraordinary. And I also at work, I have two monitors at work. One of them is an older but very large 32-inch display that is on its side, so it's in portrait mode, and I was able to plug my iPhone into that, and I basically had a ginormous iPhone. I couldn't touch it, obviously. I had to do it on the screen, but I was able to see my iPhone in that super high resolution.
The new iOS, and one of our new colleagues in our department at school was showing me this, has some built-in mirroring features, which you don't even have to be jacked into. And so I think it is like a continuity thing, which I hadn't heard about this in the Apple keynote, and I haven't seen the whole thing. But basically, when your laptop and your iPhone are in the same Apple ID logged in, you can go to your mirroring, and you can just go ahead and directly, like you are running Air Server or, you know, another program that's going to mirror your phone. I've used QuickTime Player when I've been wired in and you have to change the input, and that's worked, but this looks really smooth and seamless, and there was zero latency, unlike some of those other things. And I've got latency right now because I'm on Wi-Fi, and anyway, it was pretty impressive. So, wow, that's great. Anything else, either iOS-wise or just phone-wise, that you're noticing with the upgrade?
Well, I did add an article about this phone does get super hot, and Macworld did do an article about this. One of my strategies is that I try to charge my phone slowly. Like, I literally have an old iPhone charger, mini block, the little 5-watt one, and a USB, standard USB-C cable that I charge it on, and it charges nice and slow overnight. Or I'll do it during the day at work, and I try not to get it above 80, because, especially, you know, in the next 6 months to a year, the phone, you know, doesn't burn down that quickly battery wise. And more importantly, I know that does good things for the battery health. But I also noticed the other day when I put I do have one of the little MagSafe puck chargers, the Apple, OEM version of it. And I did plug it into my kitchen, which is where that's located at. And sure enough, it was real warm. So, it got hot, and there are people saying it's hot to the touch without a case on, which is not great. But that Macworld article talks about how they anticipate that will be something resolved with a software update, which would be, you know, awesome that they can pull that off. But that would be my only report of something weird. But yeah, I like it. It's a great device. And even though I love Chromebooks, and when I have all, you know, Google stuff together, it works decently well. And in fact, maybe a third of the time I will choose a Chromebook over something in the Apple universe when I'm working on something. The bottom line is this stuff works together so well, and I have to travel a lot in the next 6 weeks, and I'm excited about it because I can bring everything to be completely productive with me in basically a sleeve of tech stuff. And I also don't need to carry around a legacy charger anymore. So I think it's super great. I'm not going to talk about it now because I want to make sure it works first, but there is something that I noticed a program the other day. And before I announce it, I want to make sure this thing actually works, but it does some really cool things with iPads, newer iPads with USB-C connections, but I will talk about that if it works. So.
Awesome. Awesome. I'll commend again to folks to watch the Apple event that was, you know, the new iPhones, the new iOS, for multiple reasons. But one of them, and I don't think I've mentioned this in the show, are the info picks. You know, when they come to the end of a product line, hey, we've just gone through all these updates to Mac OS. We've just done through these iOS updates. They do a fantastic job creating an info pick, or I guess an infographic that is a combination of icons and words and statistics. I need to try this with Canva, but you, sir, have sung the praises multiple times of Canva. And I introduced that to my web design middle schoolers a couple weeks ago. It is really, really fun and fantastic. We did a fun assignment on Friday where we tried to create the worst web page we could. And so I think some of the animated GIFs they were trying to download were like 90 megs or something with, you know, it's just fun. And then they had to identify, you know, at least five of the principles of web design that they violated, you know, as they're creating these pages. But there's, you know, really, really compelling tools. And on the topic of infographics, I think that is probably a unit that I need to add for my media literacy students. And so anyway, Apple just, you know, sets a great bar, not only with great products, and here we are just, you know, Drew, you know, whatever, we're going crazy with our Apple fanboy statements here, but, you know, fantastic products, but they also do such great, you know, storytelling, presenting, and then I think also just using the tools and being able to use a combination of visual icons, short bits of text, being able to summarize complexity visually in a compact space is really an important communication literacy skill. And so I think Apple is a great example of that. And I'm looking forward to doing more with Canva. And as we think about literacy and what we're doing in our classrooms and our schools, and hey, I think maybe we need to be changing some of the traditional things we've been doing, creating infographics and trying to readily communicate complex things in a very straightforward, simple way that people are going to be able to understand, I think is important skill. So yay, Apple, for showing how that can be done.
Awesome.
Hey, how about I do a social media article or two, and then we can jump in the
AI.
So one of the things we've talked about on the show periodically with the, you know, acquisition of X, the website formerly known as Twitter, by Elon Musk and company, is the you know, not only replatforming of people, but the reduction, and this isn't just now happening with Twitter or X, it's happened with Facebook, the number of folks dealing with disinformation, et cetera. Well, one of the things that Twitter has, and this is the first link I'm going to drop in here, is something called Community Notes. And this is advertised as a collaborative way to add helpful context to posts and keep better informed. It's basically a crowdsourced way of contributors to write notes. And I guess compared to maybe how things happened in COVID, when you would have Twitter employees, which there were some individuals, you know, saying that these were biased and they were censoring, you know, certain voices and had a particular political bias. This is supposed to include people with diverse perspectives. It's not working for majority rules. And anyway, it's to try to provide some context. And so I found a great example, or ran across a great example on this from Twitter. And so this is really, this is the show where Wes is sharing videos that, on Twitter that you can really just get into. The headline of this is "A Horse Sneaks Into the Tour de France." This is hilarious because there are like, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 bicyclists racing, you know, with their uniforms. And this horse has jumped into the race and he's running a long ways. Well, as you scroll down a little bit, you will see the Twitter community notes kick in. And there's a little icon of three people gathered together. It says, "Readers added context they thought people might want to know. This is not the Tour de France." And it says, "In 1997, a horse jumped over a fence and joined the peloton of the Criterium International, eventually passing it, leaving the race only 20 kilometers from the finish line. The scene is often mistaken for a scene from the Tour de France race." So, and then there's a link to the Wikipedia article that talks about this. And I rated that as helpful because you can rate this. I think this is a great example to not only highlight a way that Twitter is attempting to combat misinformation and hopefully use crowdsourcing, you know, algorithms and mechanisms to try and provide context for tweets. But this is also not one that's politically sensitive. And, you know, I've talked about the moon landing stuff that we do, our conspiracy theory study on, and learning about SIFT web literacy and that kind of stuff. You know, I will feel very comfortable sharing this with my kids. And so I had not really seen that in action. Had you seen the community notes in action, and have you contributed to a community note or seen those before, Jason?
I've seen them before. I've not contributed to one. And part of it is that, I mean, I try to stay off of politics on Twitter because it's just a boatload of vitriol, but I like it. I think it's a good idea. And I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing at some point I dump Twitter. I'm just not getting the reaction I am to it anymore. In fact, I have much richer conversations on LinkedIn now than I have anywhere near Twitter. I know you're on it less, Wes, for sure. And the reason why I know that is because we don't interact there all that much anymore. That happens on LinkedIn and then on our weekly podcast for sure. But the bottom line is that there was a rumor going around, actually not a rumor, Elon Musk said it, that he's going to start charging for Twitter. I think that might be the end of it, at least the end of edgy Twitter, right? If there's free places to go that aren't as ugh, I just don't see teachers sticking around Twitter. And I'm not there for the politics. I'm there for the journalists, and I'm there for educators. That's the two groups I care about the most on Twitter.
Yeah. Well, this will link to the Geek of the Week that I'll share at the end of our show. But the other social media post I put in is actually from August 7th. And this is from the NBC News, from NBC News. And it is from the leader of the American Library Association. The headline of this is, "Top Librarian Calls Marxist Lesbian Tweet Backlash Regrettable." We have shared, and I'm sure everyone has seen, a variety of different posts. Sometimes they are about, you know, sports and athletic stars. A few weeks ago, I think we shared one by a NASCAR driver that had liked a Instagram post by someone else, and it led to, you know, him being, you know, taken out of a race and I think loss of sponsorship. And, you know, and I don't share these to say, oh my gosh, fear social media. Let's all get off social media because one misstep can, you know, lead to really bad outcomes. But this article tells the story of Emily Drabinski, who is the president of the American Library Association. And she had, without a lot of deep thought, shared a tweet, which was seized a hold of by lawmakers in Arizona, Idaho, Illinois, Georgia, Louisiana, South Carolina, and Wyoming. And they had pushed their states to withdraw support for the ALA because of that tweet from April of 2022. And so in our politicized times, I think it is really important for us all to remember that social media is really not a small space. Anything that is shared can be amplified, and we can be, you know, held to account and judged and unfortunately, you know, be really, individuals can form their entire, you know, perception about us, and just whole groups of people can, based on a single tweet or a single thing that we share on social media. So I had not heard that story before. It's quite unfortunate. libraries are so important and libraries are under siege. And I guess that's another sign of the times of our politicized landscape of information sharing, and a cautionary tale for all of us to be thinking carefully about what we're sharing and recognizing that the intended audience that we may have in mind that may be smaller can easily become much larger.
Sad but true. So, Dr. Ferrer, anything else before we just rub our face in a bunch of AI?
Let's jump into the rabbit hole.
Okay. Well, I want to share one resource that we didn't get to a couple weeks back, and I really want to share this one because I think it's really, really well done. But I know well the staff at Michigan Virtual, which is the state virtual school in Michigan. In fact, it's where my boss came from. The first executive director of MTDA was previously an executive director at the Michigan Virtual School. And I think that the work that they're doing on AI is really good. They had a couple of their kind of thoughtful folks jump in on this, and they've now released a planning guide for AI, which is a really well done toolkit for schools that would like to, you know, not just explore it and not just, you know, prepare for it, but actually seize the day and do interesting things with it. And not only do they have a great AI integration framework, which has been in the works for a couple of months, their AI guide, I think, is really outstanding. And that's good stuff. So I just want to share that tonight. Before we jump into kind of the more timely stuff, because if you're a school that's doing that and you haven't seen this resource yet, I would strongly recommend you start there and utilize their awesome resources. And shout out to my friends and colleagues from Michigan Virtual doing great work.
Yeah, the headline there on the top of the webpage, artificial intelligence doesn't replace work, it makes work more efficient. Kind of goes along with the metaphor I use of superpowers. I feel like it gives us superpowers that we didn't have before. And I think, again, a couple of weeks ago, I shared the AI guidelines that I've developed for my classroom, which are formative. But I think that that's incumbent upon all of us as instructors. Now, our institutions may have developed policies like blocking and banning and prohibiting all use. And so that's going to look a little bit different. But I mentioned that when we were at the Air Force Academy over Labor Day weekend for the Parents Weekend, we interacted with the generals and the dean and had a chance to ask about artificial intelligence. And she had said that's a instructor by instructor decision there about whether AI tools are going to be allowed and if they are, under what kinds of guidelines and what kinds of rules. And so I think that each of us need to be thinking about that. If we're especially teaching middle or high school, you can be sure that a number of your students are using these tools and are considering the use of these tools. I think it's really important that we focus on attribution and that we communicate and talk to each other about this, because AI is a reality. And if we're going to put our heads in the sand and think that, oh, this is just going to go away, it's not going to change a lot, I think we're going to be, rudely awakened very soon. So thanks for that resource, and I'll look forward to seeing the additional resources that you're going to be sharing in your upcoming journeys. And is there, aside from Twitter, is there another place you direct people? Because you've got a Google Doc, do you not, that you are
kind I of do, maintaining? Yeah. Which, yeah, that's the place that I've been updating about twice a week right now. And in fact, the most recent, it's halfpint.link/AI brief is the URL. Which I think is pretty great. And continue private chat. There is the link, sir. And so, that's where I've been putting, you know, stuff as of late. I did jump in on Thursday of last week, and there was 19 people in the document, which I was actually kind of flattered by. So, so that was pretty great. But, as an example of something that I've added in, very recently was a great resource that has about 200 pages of syllabus language from across the university world. And there's a professor that's I think I put those in here. Now I'm not seeing it now, but the bottom line is that syllabi policies for AI generative tools from a professor named Lance Eaton. And he is both on Twitter and across all the And he is a really interesting instructional designer and social media consultant. He's got several degrees, it looks like, from everywhere from a master's in American studies to a master's in education in structural design. So he's got a lot of interesting background, and he's been collecting this, you know, extraordinary trove of syllabi, that is syllabi language. And it's everywhere from absolutely not to if you're going to pull it off, here's what it looks like. And, it's great. So, and I think this is exactly the kind of sharing that we really need to be super on top of. You know, when we find things that are working, let's share it out so that we can start developing this much more quickly than the traditional share cycle, would usually suggest.
So I'd love for you to, take on this question and see also just in your interactions with other schools and districts, what they're doing with students who are not 13. Are there AI tools that kids can legally use with parent and district permission that, you know, the districts are navigating that? Padlet and the I Can't Draw is the only generative art tool that I'm aware of that our district or that our school licenses and pays for, that our students have access to. But I think that, that's an important thing. And as a middle school teacher, I'm certainly thinking about that. That's not going to be as much of an issue with high school and university. Shout out to my dad who's joining us from Liberty, Missouri tonight. Glad to have you with us. I think I'll do a quick shout out to this video documentary because as we're thinking just like that Michigan Virtual Schools is setting a frame for AI and thinking about the ways in which it can make us more efficient, you know, give us abilities and powers we don't have before. I like some of the language in this documentary. So this is from late August of 2023. It's a Bloomberg original called Microsoft and OpenAI CEOs, Dawn of the AI Wars. And it features interviews with a number of people, including Sam Altman of OpenAI and Satya Nadella of Microsoft. And what Nadella said about AI, I thought was some good language. He talked about AI is moving from autopilot to copilot, where we're really, you know, in the driver's seat in terms of prompting and crafting the kinds of interactive messages. And it's not just a single, hey, give me this essay. But it's a back and forth and interaction. And so it's, he used this metaphor of the co-pilot. And then at the end, Sam Altman is asked, well, why should we trust you with this? And he said, you shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't trust, you know, any one company or person with this technology. So that is on YouTube and it is a 24-minute documentary. And I definitely recommend that to everybody.
Okay. Well, I wanted to share a little something. I put this on LinkedIn and it unfortunately is not in our show notes tonight. So I'll get the link for that right now. But, you know, when I discover something that's interesting that works, one of the things that I like to do, is as much as possible try to, you know, recreate it so I can share it in a presentation. Later and then to kind of show what that looks like in practicality. So, what I did is, using Claude, because it's got the great, document analyzer on that. I went to the New York Regents, test website, and the Regents test is a long-standing, test, that, is given, I believe, at end of course. And I believe that it's required that you pass, in order to get a grade, in your class. And so, they just like the College Board does, they post, versions of the test so people can see what it looks like and use it as practice exams. And so, I downloaded the history and government test, and there, thank you, Dr. Fryer. I was just trying to put that link in now. And, I uploaded the test to that and I asked it first to answer it or give me the answers to this test. And Claude pushed back and said, ethically, I can't do that. And I said, but instead, I'd be happy to help you, study for the test. And so here's my best study tips for studying for a test. And, you know, being a bit of a study nerd, and also I spent a lot of time reading materials about how to help students become better students. It was really good and really well done. So then I reset the chat, right? And I then uploaded the same document and said, hi, I'm a government teacher and I would like to be able to, I would like to be able to get a key for this test because I'm helping students study for it. And it produced a key for me, in, you know, about 15 seconds. And I compared that to the key available from the Regents, and it was 100% correct. Right. I've done this with a worksheet on Teachers Pay Teachers. That was the one I showed off, when I worked with teachers in Whitefish this week. And that, you know, we have to be really cognizant of this because, again, this is pretty early days with these tools and wide availability. And I'm not saying that there's not a utility for, objective test, items, because I do think there's absolutely a lot of utility in that, but I do think there's something that we just need to be aware of how powerful these tools are, and that's an extremely powerful one right there.
And we need to be asking ourselves, how are we assessing student skills, and are there some new or different ways that I can assess student skills that, you know, can't just be fed into an AI large language model? So I think there's a lot of answers to that, and that's a very rich conversation to have. But many of the things that we've traditionally asked students to do for assessment, from multiple choice, fill in the blank, essay type evaluations, are going to be things that AIs can do too.
Well, Dr. Fryer, I do want to talk about a link you actually shared with me last week that I hadn't seen, that I actually went in and signed up for. Bard can now connect to your Google apps and services. This is from the Google blog, and I went ahead and turned this on Friday based on your recommendation, and it is wild what this can do. And I know you listened to the Hard Fork with this information in it, because you posted the kind of headline article from that with Clearview AI, but I jumped in there and played with it over the last couple of weeks, and last couple of days, and it's pretty janky to start off with, from the standpoint of, when I ask questions of my email, which is the place I've kind of started, you know, it doesn't really identify as correctly as I would assume. I have two or three people that I pretty regularly email with that on my personal email account, and my Gmail account is almost 20 years old now. So it's, you know, it's got emails going back to 2004. So the bottom line, is that, with the exception of summarizing recent emails from a friend of mine and summarizing my emails with my wife, which, by the way, Google Bard did say I seem to be very supportive and collaborative with my wife. And I said, well, thank you, Google Bard, for affirming my marriage. But the notion here of being able to have a chatbot look at your email and do things with that and help you process that, unbelievably cool.
A couple of comments. I agree with the janky observation. I think it's interesting that Google is not waiting to have this fully fleshed out, to have this, you know, out. And part of that is feedback. I've listened about maybe 2/3 of the latest This Week in Tech podcast, and they're talking a lot about AI in that session. And they're talking about Apple, you know, Apple's working on AI, but like they oftentimes do, Apple may be late to the game. And when they come out, it'll be sort of with a perfect, you know, wonderful product. I don't know. We'll see. But Google, I do not think is putting out a fully fleshed out, amazing, oh my gosh, this is so much better than ChatGPT. But what they are doing is connecting it to our data. And as we've talked about on the show, those of us that are deeply into the Google universe, you know, can perhaps have a twinge of fear with this, but I'm mainly excited. I've had some issues with my virtual web host for about 6 to 12 months. And one of the things that I tried to do immediately was have it analyze all the emails that I've received with such and such subject line from to try to identify patterns in when my server was having difficulty and going offline and coming back on. There's other logs and things like that that can record some of that. But what I found in the course of that, at least this is what I understand at this point, Bard can't search your entire archive of email. It is limited to the inbox. At least that's what it was telling me, which is a pretty significant limitation in terms of the ways a lot of us process email to get things out of the inbox. But the potential here is phenomenal. And this is where Microsoft is absolutely going to, it's not called Clippy. What is their new thing? That they just had an event where they, it was supposed to be a Surface event, I guess, and hardware. And that really was not it. It was all about AI. I don't really use Microsoft tools that much. They've got something they're calling their integrated AI assistant across everything. But anyway, this is where these companies are going, is to have the AI capabilities integrated right within your workspace and be able to use your data and work with it. So still early days, but exciting, not quite game changing, but again, this is early days and it's just going to get better.
By the way, Wes, one thing to note, and I think looking in the terms of service will probably help here too. But one thing I noticed a couple weeks back, just before I had kind of worked with a couple of principals on this stuff, is that the whole notion of kids have this in their pocket anyways. Usually the thing I cite is Snapchat AI, which their AI is actually just a chat bot. I mean, it can do some Snapchat kind of things, but you can also ask it, you know, questions about the Battle of the Bulge and it will answer them for you. But one thing to note is that Bing's AI Play, so that's ChatGPT-4 plugged into Bing, you don't need to be logged in for it at all. And although it is more limited than ChatGPT because they put more answers, or I'm sorry, they put more blocks and side rails on it, like you can go to that like it's just a public website, and it's not quite unlimited. In that I don't think you get unlimited chats with it. I do think that that's something, that just to keep in mind.
You're right. Absolutely. And we'll have to give that a try. I'll be interested to see if it can generate code. That's one of the things that, I was working with one of my students and I was putting stuff into Claude and he was kind of help, you know, feeding me some prompts and stuff like that. Copilot, Microsoft Copilot, yeah, is the AI assistant designed to handle mundane tasks and provide inspiration to creators. Being baked directly into the Windows 11 operating system, a clear indication of Microsoft's commitment to putting AI at the heart of its strategy. And that is from a VentureBeat article. Let's see if I can get a date. Microsoft's bold move introducing AI Copilot in Windows 11 from September 25th.
I just had Bing's AI write me a Python hangman game. So I think you're good to go on code.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. Okay, cool. Yet again, see, folks, the tips that we get here on the EdTech Situation Room are frequently life-changing. So there's another example. Let's talk about ChatGPT and its upgrades. Monday, Ars Technica, September 25th, ChatGPT update enables its AI to see, hear, and speak. So this is the Ars Technica article, which I read first. But have you seen the video on the OpenAI blog?
No.
Okay. This thing is, I thought, what a silly example, because it's somebody who wants to learn how to raise the seat on their bicycle. So I just dropped the Ars Technica link, and now I just dropped the OpenAI link. If you scroll down, 1, 2, 3, 4, okay, you go down to where there's a picture of the bicycle seat, and there's a circle around it, and it says chat about images. It's a 1-minute and 29-second video. This thing is incredible, and I can't wait to share this with my students because it starts really simply. It says, how can I lower the seat? But then it shows that you can take a picture of your bike. You can circle it. It identifies, let me make sure that, how do I turn the volume down on this? It identifies that it needs an Allen wrench. It identifies the size that it needs. Then the person takes a picture of their manual and then their Allen key, and it identifies which one you need to use. So like, this is where it's saying you can take pictures of your refrigerator and it'll tell you, here's the things that you can cook based on the things that I see that you have in your pantry or in your refrigerator. According to the Ars Technica article, it's going to be rolled out over the next 2 weeks. That the speech synthesis is coming to the iOS and Android apps only. The image recognition is going to be available both on the web interface and the mobile apps. That's super interesting about speech synthesis and what they're saying. And this is where the velocity of this change and then how powerful it is sort of, it can make the hair on my arm stand up. Give me goosebumps. we're going to be able to carry on just full on conversations with this thing. Did I freeze? Oh, I think my phone die. Okay, hang on. I think my phone died. So, all right, I'm going to be plugging in my phone here. So, hang on. All right, so I've kind of gushed enough. What do you think? Is this at all a big deal? Multimodal ChatGPT?
Yes, it is interesting, and I do not know how to use it yet. Because in fact, I this morning went in there to try to see if I could have it analyze some photos sitting in my phone, and I don't really get how it's used yet. It did give me an opportunity to see some more plugins that I had not played with yet that are also pretty extraordinary. But yeah, good stuff, and I am very happy. So far, at least, with the kind of direction this is going into. And I still think that in the end, it's not going to be ChatGPT, right? Like, I think this will continue to be an open model and you do cool things with it. It's what ChatGPT and Llama and Bard, and I know Google announced last week that they have another large language model they'll be releasing soon that they say is a ChatGPT-4 competitor, and Claude, and all these models. They're going to be plugged into other things that you would find more familiar to do what I assume is pretty extraordinary stuff. And I am very, very much looking forward to that.
Yeah, I mean, we're continuing to see ChatGPT really push the envelope and push the industry. I think Google is going to catch up, and the fact that they have access to so much of our data, you know, puts them in a unique place.
Yes.
But, you know, I really want Bard to catch up because I've invested in the Google ecosystem for smart speakers, and I want to be able to have, you know, this kind of phenomenal chat capability verbally. But I guess we're going to have it on our phones within the next 2 weeks. So.
Well, and I can tell you, I did plug in an old Pixel the other day and played with it, updated it and played with it. It was a hand-me-down from someone that you like to play with stuff. Kind of a deal, but they've also baked AI right into the phone now. So you can go to an article in the kind of discovery page on a Pixel phone, and there's a button at the bottom that says generate AI summary, and it's just built right into the phone now. So I would assume that in the next year or two, we're going to see some amazing stuff. And let's not forget, I don't know if we talked about this article or not, I've certainly referred to it on the show, but Apple is investing a lot of money every single day training their own AI model and working on its integration across its operating systems. And I would guess, just because in Apple I trust in regards to design, that they will probably do something amazing and extraordinary.
Yeah, I think that's a safe bet. Do you realize we've been talking for 53 minutes? This has just gone by so fast.
I know. Yeah, it goes pretty quickly, doesn't it?
Okay.
Hey, I want to answer the question that Betsy has in chat about whether we're going to be having a take on Neuralink sometime soon.
You've signed up to be a beta tester, have you not?
No. Yeah, I have enough external parts in my body that didn't come from my body that I don't need any more of those. So transplanted kidney is enough for me, but. I think we should talk about it sometime soon. I do know that some of the early animal testing has not gone super well, and I have read those articles, but I keep remembering that when I was doing my doctoral research on Siri, in 2017, 2018, one of the articles I ran into was about a group of Swedish scientists, I think it was Swedish scientists, somewhere in Scandinavia, that were working on direct brain interfaces from the standpoint of that they were looking for brain waves that had a sign that you were struggling with something because you didn't have the background information. And, you know, figuring out a way to utilize a search engine to deliver you just-in-time information as you are processing through a learning challenge, which then, of course, could turn into a creation challenge, a work challenge, a crafting challenge, a motorcycle repair challenge, like whatever that looks like. And I remember thinking at the time, holy dog, this would be extraordinary, because they were talking about basic brain links. But, you know, there are plays right now where they are analyzing brain waves, human brain waves, to be able to read your thoughts, right? That tech is ongoing. A member of my team at the University of Montana today shared a podcast with me that I can't wait to listen to, about how, remember in the movie Up, the Pixar movie Up, where they had the brain scanners for dogs, the dogs could speak.
Oh yeah.
They are working on that right now. And
tell me what's the podcast? You remember what it is?
I don't remember what it is, but I'll send you the link to it, when I listen to it. And it's, yeah, I mean, this stuff is absolutely wild. But it, you know, that seems so science fiction-y, but I don't think it's that far out of the realm of possibility.
Hey, Google Talk for Animals was an April Fool's joke about 10 years ago. So
yeah.
Now it's going to be real.
Yeah.
I want to do two.
It's a new thing.
Two more quick articles, and then we're probably going to have a Geek of the Week. We have talked before about how, you know, isn't it just like human creativity for these large language models to ingest all this information? What's the big deal? Tom's Hardware on September the 13th has an excellent article that Avram Piltich wrote called AI Lie: Machines Don't Learn Like Humans and Don't Have the Right to. And this is one of the strongest and most clear articulations that I have read to date of why perhaps we should not think of AIs and algorithms and large language models as learning just like people, in part because this has the very real potential of displacing, you know, human jobs in employment. But he also talks about that the web is going to have fewer voices. Publications will go out of business. Individuals will stop posting user-generated content out of the fear it'll be nothing more than bot fuel. I don't think this one had the picture, but some of the articles I've been reading are talking about too. If we get all of this AI-generated content and then it's feeding itself that content, it gets further and further away from reality. So anyway, I'm not doing that article full justice, but it is an excellent one and I highly recommend it. And then the other one we've referenced, but this is about Clearview AI. I think Clearview AI is probably one of the most bright line examples of a company that has gone over the line and that we need to be really concerned about. So Kashmir Hill was interviewed about halfway through the Hard Fork podcast on September the 22nd. And the title of this episode was called Breaking Bard, Who Owns Your Face and Gamer News. And the part that I really commend to you is that middle part about who owns your face. Kashmir Hill has written a book, which is now on my book to read list. And it's called Your Face Belongs to Us, A Secretive Startup's Quest to End Privacy as We Know It. And this issue of, you know, being able to have a system, which is called Clearview AI, which evidently many, many law enforcement and Homeland Security and possibly other kinds of security organizations around the country have access to, where you can simply take a picture and be able with high level of accuracy to find out who that is and all kinds of information about them, is a very big ethical question. And to highlight that, the New York Times on September the 9th published this article called, and this is actually by Kashmir Hill, The Technology Facebook and Google Didn't Dare Release. And she talks about that in the podcast. And, you know, we here on the EdTech Situation Room, I think oftentimes are beating up big tech. And we talk about the tech correction and when are we going to see these, you know, kinds of corrections? Well, evidently, this is an example of when big tech, you know, got it right from the standpoint of saying, this is so powerful and could be abused in so many ways. We are not going to put this out in the mainstream. But what we're seeing with AI is that those kinds of responsible decisions kind of don't matter because other actors, and we could call some of these bad actors, decide to do it anyway. And so that is the case with Clearview AI. It's also the case with Stable Diffusion and the fact that they have open sourced these tools. We talked about this a couple weeks ago where Greg Rakowski, I got his name. I'm 53 now, so I don't get those all the time. He's the artist that does the sci-fi or just the amazing fantasy, dragons and wizards and everything. And, you know, if you put Greg Rakowski into a Midjourney query and said, draw me, you know, a dragon in a castle, you would end up with a picture that just looked, you know, just like one of his. Well, he successfully petitioned Midjourney and some of these companies to remove all his images from their training model, but that doesn't, you know, essentially doesn't matter because we have open source folks who are forking Stable Diffusion and the open source models of these large language models, and they're just doing whatever they want. So the sad thing is the guardrails that people are trying to put on, the ethical decisions that different organizations and corporations are making are being circumvented, and what is that implication going to be for us culturally? I think that Clearview AI is something that we should be concerned about, and we should be advocating for some privacy rights in this country. And I don't know if I'm going to say this now, but besides EFF, there's going to, and I'm not saying I won't support EFF. I've a lot of their work is excellent, but they're the organizations that are working toward privacy protection. I think we need to find out who they are. It could be the American Library Association. It could be our state ed tech organization, a media literacy organization. Who is advocating for privacy law? We need to talk to policymakers, and we need to push for that. All right. That's enough of that soapbox. What do you think? Are you loving Clearview AI, Jason?
Totally great. I definitely listened to that Hard Fork podcast about it because the New York Times reporter talks about how she kept asking questions of people that were using it and then had them upload her photo, and they got their accounts turned off because they were showing it to a journalist. And that's all the information I think you need to know that this is pretty scary stuff. But, you know, our laws today that guide privacy were privacy, like the ability to someone take your photograph in public, were made, you know, over 100 years ago. And the bottom line, you know, when photography was, you know, take a picture and get it 2 weeks later after it's developed, right? And certainly not taking metadata off of it to be able to do things with that information. And we got a lot of work to do here before, you know, we're to a point where we answer some of these fundamental questions. We don't have time. We don't have time, as it turns out, to wait around for someone else to do this for us. We have to make these discussions happen now.
Well, sir, we have gone over the top of the hour, so this was like one of the fastest ones ever.
Yeah, and they keep getting faster, too. Maybe it's just our age. Well, Dr. Fryer, what is your geek of the week this week?
Well, I have a negative one and a positive one. So the negative one goes back to the American Library Association article I mentioned earlier, and this is the podcast where I learned about that. So the Ezra Klein Show, a podcast I love, on September 12th, this is from the New York Times, has an outstanding interview, and it's titled, Ezra's actually out, and so there was a guest interviewer, America's Top Librarian on the Rise of Book Bans. And so this is an interview with Emily Drabinsky. One of the things I just love that she talks about this is the idea of children having privacy and the sovereignty of the mind. And that's a controversial topic, but you know, there are limits to the kinds of controls that we put on individuals, whether they're in school or outside of school, and then on the mind itself and the importance of libraries and the advocacy that we need to be doing for ideas and for access to ideas. So that is phenomenal. But of course, it does point to that really negative social media post that she made that has led to some bad consequences. The positive, I'm a big space geek along with my wife. And so there's an Amazon Prime documentary that we have added to our watch list, and it's called A Million Miles Away. One of our astronauts actually, I think, just came back this week, who set a new record for number of time in space, over a year. This is the story of NASA flight engineer Jose Hernandez. And it follows him on a decades long journey from a rural village in Michoacán, Mexico, more than 200 miles above the Earth in the ISS. And so anyway, it just looks motivational and exciting. And it is now the number 6 most popular video, I guess, streaming on Amazon Prime, if you happen to have access to that.
Well, I would like to share a website that is a massive rabbit hole, but what is it nowadays? This is there'sanaiforthat.com, which is a massive database of thousands of AI tools. And if you're looking for the really weird ones, this is the place to go. What I like about it is that, and I need to be clear about this, I looked at this the other day. I have a bookmarking folder with 75 AI tools that were interesting for me enough to save. And I went and checked, and a full third of them don't exist anymore, because this is a space that just keeps coming and going, and people are looking for, you know, gold mines, I think. But if you want to find interesting stuff, there's an AI for that.com is the place to go. Dr. Fryer, sir, where can people find you on the interwebs?
I am at westfryer.com/after, as far as lots of links to connect with me. I'm still on Twitter and rather fractured, sharing on different places like Blue Sky and Threads and LinkedIn. But I will echo your comments. I think LinkedIn is where I'm probably having more interaction and learning more things on a daily basis. How about you?
You can go to Twitter, Tech Savvy Teach, or X, whatever we're calling it now, or LinkedIn. And at some point, I think I probably need to get a webpage up again. So that will be at knifer.com when that happens. And of course, like I do with many of my other decent ideas, I'll just knock off the Wes Fryer version of his webpage and call it good. So this isn't me copying Wes. This is the EdTech Situation. We're a once a week podcast on Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and hey, or daylight, or whatever it is right now. And hey, if you're in Europe, you're listening to us live in the middle of the night. If you can't join in live, although we had a record number of 4 live viewers tonight, which we're really happy about, keep coming back. Feel free to go to your podcast aggregator and find the EdTech Situation Room. You can go to our website, edtechsr.com, download a tiny MP3. We're on YouTube. We're on Facebook. If you just sit outside my house, you can probably hear me talking because I do it with the windows open. If you can't join us live, please download it. And also, you can see all the links from this week and all the stuff we didn't get the chance to go to, edtechsr.com/links. And Dr. Fryer,
we are a podcast on YouTube as well, because it turns out that if you have a playlist of videos, you can turn that into a podcast. And with one click, that happened this week. So yet another way we would love to have you subscribe and connect with us.
And hey, stay safe, stay savvy, and we'll see you next time in the EdTech Situation Room. Good night.